afternoon. Hello, hello. How are you this afternoon? You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in and making us a part of your afternoon. And I hope you're all enjoying the snow, because I freaking love the snow. Just be safe out there. Got a great show. We have a great show every week. We've got members of HIP, who that stands for the Historical Interpretive Programs. They're here to talk about what they do, who they are, and there's so much information that they're going to share with us for this entire hour. So thank you for tuning in and making us a part of your afternoon. Thanks so much. So today we have Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, Ralph Monaco, and Marta Slee, but she's back there in the corner. And we want to say welcome to all of you, and I'm glad you made it in safely, all of you.
Well, we didn't make it safely. My car overturned. I had to walk the last 5 miles.
But he's used to that because he's an historical interpreter. Yeah.
But thank you for coming.
I'm joking. We're so happy to be here. Thank you for having us.
You know, you guys are so much fun. And I want to tell our listeners the backstory to how I met this group of wacky funsters. Back in October, I saw a yard sign that had information about an 1800s funeral, and this was going to take place at Missouri Town. And I thought, gosh, I'm really fascinated by this, and I'm going to go because I love history and I love Missouri Town, and I kind of want to see what this is about. So when I went there, people are dressed in period costumes, attire, and they all played a particular role in history of this area. And it was fascinating because there were lawyers and judges and reverends and, of course, the deceased and all that. And it was really interesting how that unfolded as the day actually was a very long afternoon. As the day unfolded, sort of all the different details that came out during that event. Dan, can you talk us a little bit about more, give us some more information about that and how that all came about?
You bet. HIP is kind of a new thing, but we're not new to what we're doing, actually. We're just a group of loosely organized individuals. If you ever attended one of our meetings, you'd see just how loosely organized we really are. But here's what we are. We're passionate about history. We're passionate about being storytellers and recreating history as best we can. There are a lot of this area that we live in has so many wonderful layers of history.
Yeah.
And we enjoy trying to recreate some of those chapters out of our history.
So, and
we do it through, like you mentioned, through dressing in period attire. Generally, the term that is used most frequently is called living history.
Okay.
If you visit sites around the country like Colonial Williamsburg or places such as that, you're going to see interpreters in period attire who are representing chapters out of history. And so essentially that's what we're doing, but we're not part of an official site.
Okay.
Or anything like that. We do it on our own hook. Now, but we're very serious about what we do. If there's a particular story or chapter out of history that we want to present, we do a lot of research based on first-person narrative accounts. And so we have a responsibility to the public to be as accurate as we can. And we take a great deal of pride in that. And we partner. What do? We're not standing on a street corner doing it. I suppose we could. I don't know. but we partner with local historic sites. And so that's our backdrop, for example, at Missouri Town 1855, where you came and saw us. And so that's sort of our backdrop that allows us to do what we do.
Well, and I want to talk about sort of how it impacts people, you know, that living history. Do you find that, you know, it informs them more in sort of this real-life 3D sort of format? Do they have a lot of questions? Do you have followers, people that, you know, want to learn more or that you talk with afterwards?
Let me kind of put it in a little perspective. When I was a young boy, my parents would take us to Missouri Town, and it was a village with mm-hmm. buildings, and there yeah. was a park ranger, so kind of like Wally World. Hello, folks. Welcome to Missouri County 1855, and there's an old building built in 1843. Yeah. Well, years went by, and this is literally my 30th anniversary doing living history. Wow. I went out to Missouri Town with my wife, and at that time, my daughters, Lindsay and Lisa, they were like 4 and 6 months old, and I met Dave Bears, mm-hmm. and I met Greg Higginbotham, mm-hmm. and they had taken what I had experienced in the early 60s some 25 years later, and made it into a living village where it came to life. And it not only did the life breathe into me, I had a history degree from Rocker's College. Mm-hmm. I had a passion. I've written 6 history books of local history. And so I have a passion for American history, especially Western Missouri, Eastern Kansas. But Greg Higginbotham and Dave Bears instilled this passion in me that wow. has continued on. So that had been a kind of our base organization in Missouri mm-hmm. Town. But at the same time, we've done other venues, as mm-hmm. Dan articulated. Mm-hmm. But part of the backdrop of the funeral that we did this past year was to literally show that, hey, xenophobia is not something that is being discussed on the airwaves today.
Yeah, yeah.
Catholics were detested in the city. Mm-hmm. Immigrants were not liked in this city. Unfortunately, Kansas City was the mecca of foreign trade with Mexico. Mm-hmm. Father Bernard Donnelly, whom I portrayed, was a Catholic priest, and we were who was very influential in bringing immigrants to Kansas City to help tear down the mountains and hills to make Kansas City what it is today, mm-hmm. and played an integral role as one of the colonial leading fathers of our community. And that's what we did.
And I want to say that everyone that's present today at Art Speak Radio here at the station, they portrayed a particular character in history at this funeral. And David, I'm looking at you. What was your role in this, in the funeral?
Well, I was just one of the town players. I played a character I portrayed named Shadrach Combs, mm-hmm. who had early in the year married his childhood sweetheart, who was also a widower, at the village, mm-hmm. and we did a wedding. When we sat down and talked about doing a new event, it's real important to me to make sure that we represent history that is relevant, and it is relevant. We still talk about mm-hmm. things about immigration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We still talk about states' rights. Without these stories, we don't know where we've been. Mm-hmm. And if you don't mm-hmm. know where you've been, how do you know where you're going to go next? You keep making the same mistakes if you don't look at the past. And I'm passionate about that.
Yeah.
The Irishman was a great one, because people don't think of that today as Irishmen being immigrants or Catholics not being accepted by the general population.
Yeah, and the backstory to that, for people who want to know what is it we're exactly talking about, is that during this funeral, the deceased was an Irish immigrant. Of Catholic descent. Or Catholic descent, of Catholic. He was Catholic.
He's Catholic, and he's Irish.
And
two
he's
strikes
Irish.
Against him.
There you go. And so the argument was within the judge and the lawyer and clergy was, can this man be buried in this cemetery that is Protestant? And so that played into the whole storytelling that I thought was of interest. And you know, certainly of today, you know, very central to what's happening, you know, in politics and around the world. So,
and we actually used the Catholic rite of the funeral, although I've learned Latin as an altar boy in the early 60s, my Latin has failed me. But we really did try to follow what was required, and even including burying him on the grounds, because the Catholic Church then is a little bit of slack in that requirement. You had to be buried in a Catholic church or Catholic cemetery, unless, of course, there was none available. And that was kind of the side story we were going to do, because we couldn't transport him 6 miles because he'd been dead for a few days when they found him dead.
Yeah.
And and some of the cool aspects of it that you saw came about. We knew we wanted to try to recreate a funeral. Actually, we're piggybacking on some events that took place back when Greg Higginbotham and Dave Bears were working at Missouri Town, and they had programs like this. They had a recreated wedding. They had a recreated funeral. So the groundwork had been laid back in the 1990s, but we resurrected some of these programs. But as we started delving into it, we weren't just going to do a tit-for-tat replication of it. And sure. these stories started emerging. That was the cool part about it, telling the story mm-hmm. of an Irish mm-hmm. laborer who was deceased and his poor widow with children who is destitute, and she and her husband cannot be buried in the cemetery there in the village. So these wonderful human stories emerged. And mm-hmm. I think that's what really people really got something out of it, is that it wasn't too didactic or academic, that following Victorian mourning customs. It, mm-hmm. it was more of a story of people in this community and how they dealt with real-life things or real-death things that took place.
And, Greg, your role for the funeral, were you a lawyer? You were a lawyer, weren't you, in that?
I was not. I was not a lawyer. Probably one of the original founders of the town.
Oh, okay.
I was
okay.
an early settler in that area, mm-hmm. probably had been in mm-hmm. Independence maybe a short time, mm-hmm. and then decided to possibly for land and agrarian type interests, mm-hmm. I would have gone ahead and moved over into that area. So what happens is I probably started the town. Everyone then kind of friends or relatives or whatever then would have surrounded that area. So I think the person I portrayed was the wealthiest individual in the town, mm-hmm. and then you found all kinds of social and economic and that type of thing that moved in around me. There would have been a tavern there that also served as a hostelry. You would have found the blacksmith. Of course, it was farming community. Mm-hmm. There would have been slaves there. This was Missouri in 1850. So you'd have seen and I would have been a slave owner. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that brought up a little bit of the conversation about what my part was. The cemetery, I owned the cemetery, mm-hmm. and I had also owned the ground where the church was erected. So that was important to me. Mm-hmm. Of course, the person that I portrayed probably more than likely would have been a Democrat in politics. He would have been fairly well educated. For the most part, he was a slave owner. Mm-hmm. And everything kind of came about with my concern with having this Irishman and this Catholic mm-hmm. being buried in my quote cemetery. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, this man had been working for me. So you find it kind of interesting about how I would have employed him, would have paid him mm-hmm. to do whatever it was that I needed him to do. But then I would have been very reluctant to have him buried in our cemetery. And that came part of what we were doing there.
There was no workers' comp laws back then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if you just tuned in to ArtSpeak Radio, I want to let you know that we're talking to members of HIP, which is the Historical Interpretive Programs. We're talking with Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, and Ralph Monaco here at the station. And, you know, there's such a interest in the history, first of all, that got you, each of you, involved in, you know, in these programs. But you all have different backgrounds, because I know I've talked to Dan at length. He's a graphic artist and all that. How did you find your way through all through HIP? How did you meet? How did you meet up with one another?
Well, I'll start off with Mr. Higginbotham. Mm-hmm. I was living in rural Jackson County, and I had horses and such. And one day I was at a store buying a chore coat and ran into Higginbotham, and he was looking for a horse trainer for Missouri Town. So he kind of hired me to do that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And from that, I got really lucky. I learned, in my opinion, from one of the best two first-person interpreters in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Greg is kind of the founder of the feast for me. He instilled that love of correctness in yeah. history.
And David, did you and I have a conversation about being a part of a filmmaking team? Or
yes.
Okay, yeah.
Greg actually got to work for me, or I guess we both got together, for a company here out of Kansas City. It's uh-huh. one of the best documentary film companies when it comes to history, and that's uh-huh. Wide Awake Films.
Okay.
And I never trained for movie work, and I don't think Greg did either. We just kind of fell into it. But I yeah. think we've done a fair job. I think we've won a number of Emmys with Wide Awake for historical
documentaries. Congratulations on that, yeah.
very proud of that work.
Now, yeah. I had been a firefighter and decided that I probably should maybe try a different occupation.
Uh-huh.
And so the way I got involved was through Missouri Town with Jackson County Parks and Recreation, mm-hmm. which operates the site, mm-hmm. the historic program a group that, oh, I think they formed up in about 1985 or 1986. And so I was hired on as to be an interpreter there. Mm-hmm. And one of my primary reasons for going there was to turn it into what we call a living history village or a town. Right. They had the structures.
Mm-hmm.
They had the idea of kind of what they wanted to do. And so the site executive director of the parks at that time, she said, hey, why don't we start a living history program? Why don't we do it and do it really well?
Mm-hmm.
And let's try some, we can spark an interest in people here in the county, and it'll also involve doing correct period attire,
mm-hmm.
customs. Then we started doing rare breeds with the livestock at the town.
Wow.
We put a special interest in the gardening
mm-hmm.
techniques mm-hmm. And various other things that went with it, as well as the special events that Dan had talked about previously. So I worked there for several years and put together a really good living history program at that time. And it's not what we had made it, you mm-hmm. know, presently,
mm-hmm.
but at least we set a tone for yeah. actually what could be done. And then that's how kind of HIP was born, because
mm-hmm.
we
mm-hmm.
still had that passion because we'd all been there volunteering mm-hmm. or being paid to do that at one time. And we had done really some fantastic events mm-hmm. from elections to funerals to weddings to Independence Day to Planters Day, Tradesman's yeah. Day, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of really cool stuff that come out of that. And now HIP was born out of that.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I guess I'm a part of it. I reluctantly said, I don't know.
He's the father.
I really don't know if I want to do this, but, hey, what the heck, how can I bail mm-hmm. out on these guys that I've known for this long? And I really appreciate what they do for me.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, okay, I'll come along then. And,
you know,
and have you all subjected to me, I guess.
Oh, my goodness. You know, and we keep referring to Missouri Town, and that, if people haven't been on site there, it's a recreation of a little town, Missouri Town, in the 1800s, and you can kind of get a snapshot, a glimpse of what maybe life was back then. You know, some of the buildings were found in other locations and then moved to this, to Missouri Town. And I believe that is Lee's Summit, right? Or is it Lone?
It's
kind of borderline.
By Lake Tacoma. And
yeah.
I think technically the address is Lee's Summit, but it's kind of like between Lee's Summit and Independence and Blue Springs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
my background as started practicing law, I think, when Moby Dick was still a minnow. This is my 38th year as a lawyer. But going back to my date in 1989, they have a law office. That was an extant law office from that time period.
Right.
They didn't have a lawyer. And I figured, well, I could be a lawyer. And I've literally, this will mark my 30th year as a town lawyer, Abram come and go.
Right.
And I've been out there, and I've studied, and I've worked. And, again, pounding the same fist on Dan and Greg and Dave, they are like the godfathers to me, not trying to use my Italian heritage, but they're like the godfathers to me as far as people that I look up to, that I respect. And when they finally says to Ralph Monaco, hey, you can be part of this, I finally found like, if using the Catholic term, had gone to heaven, died and went to heaven.
Yeah.
I kind of feel that way when I'm with these guys, because we blend together so well, we get along so well,
mm-hmm.
and we all now educate one another.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal is not to just educate ourselves, but educate everybody who takes part in a program that we present. And we do emphasize authenticity, clothing, language, knowledge of the material that we're producing. And it's not just limited to Missouri Town. I mean, we do other sites, Fort Osage, et cetera. But Missouri Town is where we all had our genesis, if you will.
And our membership is not limited to who's just sitting at the mics today. And
okay.
we don't. And our membership is rather loose. Our little group, we don't have dues. We don't have bylaws. Our meetings are like herding cats sometimes.
We have no stinking badges.
No stinking badges. Yeah. But we have a group of, well, you attended the funeral event. I think there were upwards of 30 or so participants there. And we did a wedding event in June of last year mm-hmm. at the same site. And I think we had over 50 participants. And some traveled from Texas, as far as Texas and North Carolina. Why? Because it's a circle of people in this hobby, and we're aware of the quality. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know each other, even though we're geographically spread out. But it's kind of the build it and they will come mentality. Yeah. We put together this cool little boutique kind of event, and they say, oh, I want to come take part in that. So our membership is loose. Not everyone mm-hmm. will attend every event. Mm-hmm. But to touch on what Ralph was saying, we all pool our resources in terms of our knowledge.
Okay.
That way, we're trying to make sure we don't miss a step in terms of research and the information we need to put on a proper quality event mm-hmm. in terms of authenticity.
Yeah, we're going to take a real quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk about not only the story, how it evolves, but I also want to talk about some of the clothing, because one of the things that caught my eye was the clothing. So beautiful, and I was able to find out more from each of the characters how that came about. So we're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll be back with ArtSpeak Radio.
Support for KKFI is provided by Squeezebox Theater, a performance and event space at 1519 Oak Street in Kansas City's Crossroads District. Designed with producers and performers in mind, presenting music, including local artists and touring singer-songwriter showcases, variety shows, poetry, film, stage plays, improv, and more. Learn more about venue availability, upcoming events, and tickets at facebook.com/Squeezebox Theater.
Ruby Grant, welcoming you to join me every Wednesday, 3 p.m. until 6 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, a vintage classic format designed to educate and increase the awareness of accomplishments and contributions made by Afro-Americans. Now that's every Wednesday, right here on KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Our listeners love to support organizations that support KKFI. To reach a diverse and active community, become a community marketing partner. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Thanks so much for tuning in to ArtSpeak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez-Boyd with a hip group of guys. The Historical Interpretive Program members, Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, Ralph Monaco, and Marlis Lee in the corner. And we want to give a shout-out to Lindsay. So thank you, Lindsay, for tuning in and, enjoying the program, because I am enjoying it. I love talking history with these guys and how they evolved, how they came about. And where we're going to go next is about sort of the storyline with each location that you've presented your stories at. How does the story get written, per se? Dan?
That's a great question.
actually, a lot of whiskey.
We know what we want to do.
Yeah.
For example, the funeral, and as I alluded to earlier, we had a reference point. We had the program that was done in the 1990s, so we already had a wealth of resource material. But then, as I also said, a story started emerging. Said, "Hey, what if we did mm-hmm. this, or what mm-hmm. if we did that?" And that's part of the magic of having people who are talented have that perspective of history. You can't just will that kind of stuff. You know history, and that perspective allows you to present a facet. Hey, what if we do this? That's right. Like Ralph talking about Irish immigrants and the problems they encountered, or mm-hmm. Or the discrimination against Catholicism. So things like that started appearing, and then a storyline just started emerging. And mm-hmm. we never write a script that here's your lines, memorize your lines. Never, ever. It's not about that. Mm-hmm. You basically research your character, and you understand the gist of what we're doing. We have a schedule. we're partnering with a site, okay? Mm-hmm. And you're, okay, you guys are doing your thing from 2 to 3, and then from 3 to 4, there's blah, blah, blah. So we kind of know what that's going on there. But we inhabit the character. You research your character. Mm-hmm. You know you're going to have an encounter. So now, does not go beyond that. No memorized lines, because mm-hmm. then it would be really kind of boring. I think maybe even you could talk yeah. about what you saw, encountered, as far as the interaction between the participants. It was more...
Not really.
Okay.
Let me get you to talk,
because I like your voice better than mine.
Can I say something?
Absolutely.
We learned a long time ago that if you make history interesting and cinematographize it, is that a word?
No.
Make it like a movie.
Yeah.
Folks will
there
love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is improvisational method acting yeah. with history. Is all it is.
Yeah, it really was that way, you know, and I think that's, you're right, it really invited me into that conversation. I almost felt like a voyeur, because this conversation about, you know,
and that's what we want yeah. you to do. We want you to yeah. be a voyeur. We yeah. want you to and listen to what we're talking yeah. about.
And you were standing right there. I mean, there wasn't like a, it wasn't cordoned off. Here, you stand behind yeah. this rope. You could walk right up okay. to somebody if you want and
right,
insert
right.
yourself into the situation if you wanted. But not all events are like that necessarily. Yeah. Like, for example, Ralph could talk. We did a recreated trial. Might we'll touch on that.
Yeah.
That
wow.
was a, technically a hip event, but it had players in it.
Yeah, I've actually, in Jackson County Historical Society, in conjunction with UMKC Law School, I've produced now, I believe, 7 living history mock trials, from Jesse James mm-hmm. Jr. to Dr. Mm-hmm. Hyde for the alleged murder of Colonel Slope, to Whiskey Head Ryan's train robbery with Jesse James, the Glendale train robbery, to the famous bridge trial where Myrtle Bennett was accused of murdering her husband over a game of bridge. So we have literally bridged, pardon the pun, we bridged the 1870s all the way through the 1930s, and that's what this mm-hmm. organization does. Mm. So when I put together a mock trial for continuing legal education for lawyers or for the community, I call upon the same members who are in participants cool. in HIP. Uh-huh. They've also played. But we've also done, the lawyers are portrayed by actual lawyers. Judges mm-hmm. are actually portrayed by judges here in Kansas City. And what we do is we give them a trial outline. And it's the same thing that you give to the cast in
sure.
HIP. You say, this is the story we're going to tell. You're going to portray the widow. And these are your 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you're from. In Ireland, and this mm-hmm. is when you came to Boston, mm-hmm. this is how you came to Kansas City, and then they have to do their own study. So there's 2 ways you do living history, basically. One is third-person interpretation,
mm-hmm.
that is, this is how they did it back then, or
yeah.
first-person, this is how I do it. And we prefer, now we do both,
mm-hmm.
but primarily I think what makes HIP so much hipster, if you
mm-hmm,
will,
mm-hmm.
is that we do really focus on first-person interpretation. So we immerse yeah. the person. So when they come in to the village for the funeral, it was a Catholic funeral in October 1858. And all the President of the United States at that time was James Buchanan. And the Vice mm-hmm. President of the United States was John Breckinridge. And the Governor of Missouri was. And so we go through all that.
But it's much more than just those facts.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have
yeah.
to put in emotion. We have yeah. to make you a part of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, if you
that.
Noticed during the funeral, there was no one in that pine box. But everyone that gathered around... There, you saw bits of emotion there.
Yeah.
There were.
Yeah,
I saw yeah. several visitors
yeah.
who actually were kind of teary-eyed. And I was thinking at that point, boy, did we get the job done today.
Ooh-ah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I felt really good about that.
Yeah.
But when you talk about first person, I've been to a lot of different historic sites
uh-huh.
and volunteered at quite a few Civil War battlefields and other sites. But first person interpretation is really difficult. It's extremely difficult. And you can't work, it's not a stage play. We're not working off the script like Dan had
mm-hmm.
said.
Mm-hmm.
You've really got to know your history.
Wow.
You've got to know how to conduct yourself, how to, your poise. You know, sometimes you sound kind of terrible to people,
mm-hmm.
but that's part of your character.
Nice.
First person is really important. If you do it correctly, you've done a really good job. And that's really important to us, not only how you look, but what you say. And we're making sure that, boy, it's spot on. So we don't want to get
yeah.
busted.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, as you were talking about, each character has to do their research. What are some of the resources that you reach out to find some of the facts and figures and kind of define who this character is or the time.
Well, I'm very lucky. I got to doing a bit with Greg called the Cole Younger Frank James Historical Wild West. Luckily, there's a lot of information out there that Cole actually himself wrote. Most of it's false, but you can
big
read it. But he's a great character, just like Greg's character, Frank. Total opposites. We were asked to do a show on television and refused to do it because they insisted we do a script. And when we sat down and decided we were going to do those two characters, we weren't going to script it. It wouldn't be sing-songy. It would be two old guys just talking about the past, and we'll hook them. That's what's fun when you hook the audience. Yeah.
Well, that's something that's really special about the first-person impersonations that I've seen Greg and Dave and Ralph, too, do. As a spectator, you walk up and you hear some people conversing, and it's not forced. It's not like, now I voted for Abraham Lincoln in 18... It's not
Dan,
like that.
Your line is...
Actually, it's so good. It's so effortless, in a way, that you think almost think, oh, I caught them, they're off-duty. You caught them talking about, oh, I had to go to the DMV today or something. No, it's not. If you stop and listen, they're talking about, hey, he just bought a 15-hand mare or something. You know, and all of a sudden, you kind of have this little aha moment. You're going, wow, this is cool. You know, and so that's what we try to achieve. And what does it require? It requires a lot of reading. You know, I'm not the best researcher in the world, but we live in an age now where more and more digitizing of wonderful resources. So you can really find just about. We're not above Googling things. We're trying to find who was governor of Missouri in 1847. Well, if we didn't, Ralph knows. But I mean, you can Google little things like that. But we do a lot of research. Not just for first person first hand narratives, but also photographs too. In terms of clothing, researching photographs, studying photographs are imperative for getting the clothing right.
Yeah, and that's something we haven't touched on just yet. I've got to air a couple of spots, and then we're going to be right back because we not only want to talk about a little bit more of what we're discussing now, but also the dress. And even though we have a panel of men here, there are women that are involved too. So I know that was important for each of you to address. But we're going to be right back right after this.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two, Two Takes, a movie currently playing in the Kansas City area. And today the topic is an acclaimed film from director Barry Jenkins, who was best known for his Oscar-winning film Moonlight. And this is an adaptation of James Baldwin's novel, and it's called If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yes, and the film begins with a quote from James Baldwin, in essence, that every city, every state has a Beale Street, which is symbolic of where most African Americans live and how they live. I found the film to be very engaging. The characters were well done. The love story, the angst that two families went through because of simply being an African American in the United States.
Right. It's a social drama with, you know, all of the implications of that really disguised as a love story. The love story part works. The actors are very fine. And incidentally, Regina King, who has a supporting role, won the Golden Globe as well as the Critics' Choice Awards for her performance. I think the cinematography is beautiful in this movie.
Yes.
And the score was terrific. I think all of those are award worthy. But really, this is Barry Jenkins' movie, and he proves to be a really good fit with the tone and feel of James Baldwin.
It leaves a person with a sense of sadness, and why can't our society get its act together?
Yeah, which is similar to what we saw in Moonlight as well. And it captures some of that same feel. It's not quite as good as Moonlight, but it's a very good film.
And, you know, if you're still interested in this topic, you might want to revisit the movie with Sidney Poitier, and it's A Raisin in the Sun.
I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two.
Extinction Rebellion, a nonviolent direct action movement, mobilizes mass civil disobedience in the British Isles. Hear what they do and how they do it on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Cuba gets demonized all the time by Republicans and Democrats alike, but 95% of Cuban workers voluntarily belong to unions, and women get a year of paid maternity leave. Find out more about Cuban workers this week on the Heartland Labor Forum. Also, Donald Trump is eviscerating policies and legislation that favor working people. We'll talk to journalist Stephen Hill to find out how far labor has been set back by these efforts and if the working class can identify the real enemy of the people. Tune in Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Thanks so much for tuning into ArtSpeak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd. We're on air. Yay. Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, Ralph Monaco, and Marlis Lee. I do have to mention Marlis. She's hiding in the corner back there. But they're members of HIP, which stands for Historical Interpretive Programs. And it's a fascinating storytelling, live storytelling events that take place. And we're going to talk about some upcoming projects and past projects. But we were talking about sort of the research, how you sort of shape the characters that help shape history. So a lot of it is done through the internet and finding information that way, and then another is...
Well, I mean, I can speak for myself. I've written six books of local history, and research certainly is a lot easier than it used to be, but you go to Chronicling America, the newspapers, Secretary of State's office to get actual newspaper accounts of what was reported. There's the Western Missouri Valley Room of the Kansas Public Library has
that's fabulous.
Research source.
Yeah.
Jackson County Historical Society has a nice archives.
What about the genealogy?
Is that
helpful?
Mid-Continent Public Library has a great genealogy. A lot of microfilm that really makes it easier to do the research, and they're very hands-on in assisting you. And I think that's who you work for, isn't it, Greg?
yes, somewhat. Uh-huh. They're part of the consortium that I'm involved with.
But there's so many different good areas of where you can get local history research, but it's also reading secondary sources. Great historians who've written, learning is part of what we do, and to be there, you've got to read, you've got to research. And as I think Dan said, we all take a certain part. Like my job for the funeral was to take care of the Catholic component of what the mass or the funeral would be. Dan took on the role of the Baptist minister, who was certainly not very friendly to the Catholic church and the poor Irishman who died. Mm-hmm. Dave portrayed a man who converted to Catholicism because his trade was on the Santa Fe Trail, and he had made his fortune, but he converted to Catholicism. So
Religious belief, just because it was good economics for him to become a Catholic.
Why? Because you're dealing with the Mexicans. Right?
Well, it was part of the law when they started trading that you had to be a Catholic to do business, so they would convert to Catholicism.
Well, you know, and through all this, and again, I have a panel of men here that are members of Historical Interpretive Programs, or HIP. There's also women that are involved. I know one of the individuals that would have been here today, Heather Campbell.
Mm-hmm. And she was very, very upset. She couldn't
bless
make
her
it.
Heart.
K-10
yeah.
and I-70 were not really clear good enough for her to make it in. So we're pretty heartbroken, but we'll try to muddle through without her.
Oh, well, but, you know, I want to mention that. All of you have an interest, a deep interest in history, and whether you've written books about it or really done the research. Heather also has an MA in public history from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So her thesis topic was early French and Native American settlers of Cosmouth, which was future Kansas City, and she's working on a book. So you all have sort of this vestment in history and knowledge and wanting to share, and there's room for women in history. And so you want to talk about that?
There is definitely history about women. Yeah.
Marlis does this too.
Marlis is one
of our members that doesn't speak. Yeah. A lot of people don't want to speak. To observe. Yeah. Marlis is now starting to do speaking roles, but she didn't feel comfortable coming on today, so we're not going to make it come.
But we had a great representation for a wedding event back in June, and the funeral too.
Yeah.
Gals, we could rattle off 30 names of people, but we have a great representation of women, and of course that's critical.
And I wanted to bring that to light because, like I said, I'm sitting here with a panel of men, and women are very active in this group. So
let me just say this about our group. what we aren't are what we really are have evolved, I think, beyond is being Civil War reenactors. And I think most people are can't swing a dead cat without hitting somebody that's attended a Civil War reenactment. Mm-hmm. And they're cool. They're neat to see. But I think in terms of we're trying to touch on more human interaction with people, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so our events are civilian-centric type events. Nothing wrong with touching on the Civil
sure.
War.
Sure.
That's the basis of a lot of what we do, but it's not solely based on that.
Most of your Civil War events are about putting on a big show for mm-hmm. folks, and it's a dog and pony show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We long ago discovered that you can do better with quantity than quality.
Right. Right.
Quality over quantity.
You bet.
That too. Yeah, you know, and speaking of which, I do want to touch on the garments that you all wear for any particular event. That, to me, of course, you know, being an artist, I love the aesthetics of a good quality garment that's made. And a lot of the people involved in HIP make their own garments, whether it's the pants, you know, the trousers, the hats, jackets,
and
all. Can
I speak on that briefly?
Yeah, please.
We were talking about films here earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of historical films we've done out of this area. And found myself facing even 1920s Boilermakers. And I thought, uh-oh. And so a lot of research came into that.
Uh-huh.
As early as probably the 1830s is what I'm comfortable with doing.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
as David mentioned before with the Cole Younger and Frank James, these are a couple of men who are in their 60s now, in their late 60s, and it's about 1905. So it's a brand new 20th century. And so your dress changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we always consider when we're sitting around, usually at Dave's house, discussing what event we're going to do next, because we always take the women into consideration, because men usually, for the most part, can do a large span of the 19th century mm-hmm. and even into the early 20th century, and their clothing doesn't change a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the women, there's all types of different fashions that are being made at that time. And if you look at a woman, say, in the mid-19th century, and by the 1870s, when she gets this thing that's called a bustle, then you start looking at these large crinolines, and they start working their way more narrow, and then the buttocks mm-hmm. become enlarged mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. their bustles and that sort of thing. And so you're always faced with, uh-oh, yes. And yeah. Dan was giving me the money sign. And there's a lot of times when you make your own period attire and you put careful research into this that you want to be correct for your eye appeal.
Yeah.
And you basically say, uh-oh, how much money am I going to put in this? And are we going to put these ladies in kind of a financial struggle to make themselves part of? We did that with the Myrtle Bennett trial. That was in the 1930s. And, boy, you had to go to, you know, extremes to make yourself go from, say, 1870s or 1900 to 1930s.
But some of the garments that you all construct, are they done through photographs? I know you can't just go to a McCall's, pattern number, 16,
well,
52.
Yeah.
but I mean,
the period patterns, there uh-huh. are a lot of people uh-huh. who manufacture
yeah.
historic clothing throughout the United States, and we have found those through the internet or going into, we've been around long enough to where we know who to go to that does the best stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about it is,
and
that's what we look at. Money that we could have probably bought a bass boat and done bass fit, be a bass fisherman cheaper than what we did this hobby for.
Uh-huh.
Just because the amount of clothing we're having to buy to portray different time periods.
Mm-hmm.
And we always tend to go for the best we can get.
Yeah.
And that's one thing we've talked about in our little group we've put together is, hey, what stories do you want to tell now? We're talking about looking at the Prohibition era or things like that, but you have to discuss the devils and the details.
Yeah,
we have proper attire is a whole another discussion, not just for men but for women too, and not everyone in our loosely formed group has the means to mm-hmm. drop a bunch of bills into getting an outfit. Some do, some don't.
Yeah.
And not everyone can or will want to, but we're setting our sights on doing that.
Which is exactly why the word costume
cringes in our consciousness when we hear it. Because
did I say costume?
No, you did not. What kind of costume we'd be wearing? Yeah. I am not going to A to Z costume store today and renting a costume.
Yeah.
I did that in 1989 one time when I first got involved in Missouri Town, and I heard the wrath of Greg, and he was spot on, and I learned from what I didn't know going in, but I learned from doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So I'm just buying a pair of proper period boots may set you back $300 or $400. And if you're going to do it right, you're going to buy a beaver hat, and you're going to do an Ascension, which is the top one that you see Abraham Lincoln wear.
Right.
That's kind of a common one of that time period. You're going to go back $400 or $500, and you can keep going on and on. And then you talk about the frock coat or the sack coat or the fill in the blank coat. And then you're going to be spending, as Dave said, we can go out and buy a bass boat for the amount of money we've just spent putting this character together.
Yeah.
And then we do want a bridge because we think there's such a void of living history in Jackson County that's dedicated to, we'll just call it loosely, the Pendergast era.
Yeah.
James A. Reed, Harry Truman, although we have the Truman Library. But again, it goes back to what Dan was just saying. To do 1920s, 1930s, we're certainly not going to wear the 1850s or the 1880s outfits. And we won't rent them at a costume store.
Right. A costume might be suitable for a theatrical presentation. That's why it's called a costume.
Right.
We're doing, the people that will potentially come to see us do what we do, we'll be standing shoulder to shoulder with them, and our clothing needs to withstand that kind of scrutiny.
Yeah.
And we're, let's face it, we're educating the public by putting this out to
true.
Them, and we have a responsibility.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that some of the pants that, I don't remember the fellow's name, he makes hats. Is that Garrett?
Oh, Garrett, yeah. Garrett could not be here today either.
He had, he was talking about, because, you know, I kind of pulled him aside, come here. And so he was very kind and very generous to share with me sort of his construction of his pants and the fabric that he gets them, purchased them at. And it's not just, okay, I'm going to go to this, you know, Joann's or something and pick up, you know, some denim. It was, you know, detailed.
We look with a great deal of pride towards young people like Garrett, who just pick up the ball and run with it. He just doesn't follow in the wake of what we're doing. He's doing his own thing, and it's so exciting to see a young person really be passionate about that as well.
Yeah.
And to the point where he's, like you said, doing things on his own hook, but he's doing it through research, not just flying by the seat of his pants.
Yeah.
And that adds another thing that you know, we're all contemporaries age-wise, but our group, the hip group, the age is high school. Garrett's, at Raytown South High School, and he is probably more knowledgeable than I would ever be on clothing, and I'm 62, just to be very blunt. I may know a little bit more about the law, but I would certainly go talk to him about the clothing and how it should look. Maybe I don't. Maybe he knows more. But then so I would say the group's age and the gender is pretty well male and female 50-50. The age extends from high school, literally, referring to Garrett, and there's others that are his age or contemporaries.
Adult geezers like us.
Well, we have, I think we are maybe the longest in the tooth of the group, but mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
We're nearing the mid-60s, the early 70s time period. But so you can see a large span of age.
Yeah.
That's participating.
And there were children out there at the funeral, too. You know, the widower's children, right?
Well,
right.
One of the members in our group have children. And those children, like my daughters, Lindsay and Lisa, when they were, I would take them out there and I would dress them in period clothing. And eventually they decided that was not their passion.
The two young ladies that were the deceased daughters were actually a member of ours, Brian McCarty and his young daughters. And he's impeccable in his dress.
Yeah.
Another one of those guys that if you have a Brian McCarty shirt, it's kind of like a deal.
And Brian
very
McCarty
good maker of clothing.
Yeah, he sews fantastic stuff, and he sewed all of his girls' attire. So
I remember seeing those.
The slat bonnets and the dresses is really remarkable.
You know, we're going to take a real quick break with ArtSpeak Radio, and we're going to be right back, so don't go away. Hey, we're back. This is ArtSpeak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd. Yes, thank you so much for tuning in today and every day, noon to one. We love being in your ears. And we've got, we're hip today. We're with members of the Historical Interpretive Programs. That's Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, and Ralph Monaco. Thank you all so much, for sharing what you do with us and for the community, because it's really important to have this living history, getting people involved and invested in and something that's taken place across Missouri. So thank you so much for that. I want to talk about a couple of things. One is, what is your wish list for upcoming events? I mean, is there something that you haven't done yet, but it's like, ooh, we need to do this? Is there something that you want that's percolating?
Yeah, I briefly touched on that a second ago, that we really would like to take a hard look at the Pendergast era, the whole time period of the 1930s, the Prohibition era in Kansas City. I mean, there was once a famous quote that said, if you want to find sin, forget Paris, go to Kansas City. Kansas City was not a dry city during Prohibition. And that's an era that I think fascinates people. But we do have another event coming up this year.
I'm going to speak briefly on it. Dan's probably in the driver's seat on this, but it's a second time that we've probably worked at this one, which will be the 1856 election. That'll be the presidential election of 1856. And so we've already started to do a little bit of legwork on that and again at Missouritown. And it'll be a rural setting, but there'll be electioneering there, although it never happened at Missouritown because that's actually a fictitious town. But either way it goes, it kind of gives an idea of what the Jackson County polling station would have been at that time. And, of course, one of the problems that we find with the 56 election is the territory of Kansas has already become involved with statehood and with the slavery and with entering the Union as a free state and Missouri being a slave state. And so this will all be worked out during the 56 election. I'll let Dan speak a little more on that event.
Excuse me. Part of the storytelling is there's a lot of very tumultuous things happening in the politics between Missouri and Kansas at that time. And we don't want to sidestep that or sweep it under the rug. Sometimes chapters out of our history are not all pleasant, but history is history. And we want to tell that story, too. So that's going to be part of our storytelling as well. The date on that, by the way, is going to be Saturday, August 24th at Missouritown.
So is there a website or any social media that you can share with our listeners so they can maybe mark that on the calendars?
Absolutely. We don't have a website, but we have a Facebook page. Okay. But if they get on there and just search for HIP, Historical Interpretive Programs, they'll stumble upon us.
And most likely, maybe if you have upcoming events like at Missouritown or Fort Osage or something, maybe their websites might contain some information about
that. We also partner with local historical societies. I'm on the board of directors of the Lone Jack Historical Society, and so we also have events at the Lone Jack Battlefield site out at Lone Jack. So we're on the cusp of making really fun, great things happen with different historical sites and organizations around the region.
Yeah, and I know I have had a long conversation with Dan a few weeks ago, and relatively this is a new group that has developed from this interest of history and your experiences and all that. So it's still kind of informing in a sense.
None of us are new to the hobby, but this endeavor is new.
Right. Yeah.
This will be our second year.
Yeah, second year. And so we're looking forward to doing great things.
I've been doing living history now for 30 years. Greg's been doing it for 40 years. Yeah. Dave's been doing it. Dan's been doing it that length. We've all been doing it, so we're just bringing our collective talents together now as one group.
Well, I know, again, with the conversation that I had with Dan, and there's so much history throughout this whole country and all, and fortunately, there's a wealth of history that still to be discovered or the stories told. here in Independence or Kansas City or Westport or that sort of thing. So you'll never be without any sort of resource.
The great historian David McCauley once said that there's no county in the United States with a richer history than Jackson County, Missouri. Wow. And having done research and writings for the periods from the 1850s all the way into the 1930s, I can tell you he's spot on in his analysis.
Beautiful.
Just want to inject here, we're always looking for people that need our help. We don't charge for any of this. We usually pay our own way.
Terrific.
If we put on an event and we feed our group, we do it out of our pocket. We're here to help historic sites if they want us. Yep. So get on the Facebook and contact us. We're always looking for new programs to
Very
do.
Very good. And you know what? I we're out of time, and hour goes by fast, doesn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. We love you guys. Thank you so much for sharing what you do with us in the community and sharing your talents and your voices, lending your voices on air today. And, you know, I'm really, really disappointed we didn't use our old-timey voices, but maybe next time.
Back in 1855.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you to Dan Hadley, David Beers, Greg Higginbotham, and Ralph Monaco. Next week, January 30th. That's the end of January, folks. That's it. We'll feature Kian Byrne. He'll be here. And Sarah Walsh. Ruben Castillo will join us. And up next is our very favorite, our very own Jeff Harshbarger, Jazz Afternoon. We love our Jeff Harshbarger. And I'm going to give him a big kiss when I see him. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And like I say every week, honey, I'm coming home.